You dismissed occasional brief glimpses of me as tricks of the Azor of the Light. We were now headed down a steep incline on the trails. The trees and chaparral, as well as the hills themselves, were throwing shorter shadows. As the morning grew later, more walkers, with and without dogs and joggers, began to dot the landscape. I studied his countenance. He was truly enjoying himself, I assumed, based upon his beaming face. And the truth of matter is, I also was feeling fantastic. And why not? It was a lovely day. You thought you had seen a ghost, he said. Oh. Ugh. It finally sunk in. Of course, I had seen ghosts when I was a kid. What child hasn't? But as I aged, I determined that those sightings were nothing more than heightened childhood imagination. Like most kids, I loved scaring myself and others as well with tales of ghost sightings and other events designed to send a cold shiver of fear down the backbone. That's why we spent many a Saturday sitting through continuous showings of such delightfully frightening films as The Comedians Abbott and Costello meeting up in spine-tingling action with Wolfman, Dracula, or Frankenstein. You are not telling me that some of the ghosts that I supposedly saw as a kid were real? I asked. Apparitions, Paul replied. What? Not ghosts. Apparitions. And, yes, some of those sightings could have been more than a mild hallucination, a trick of the light, a speck of dust in a watery eye, or any number of other misinterpretations. I would guess that almost everyone at some time in life thinks he or she has seen a ghost. But those of us who don't believe in such things don't take the stories seriously. Still, there must be a reason why such tales have been told over the ages in every corner of the world. Paul offered his own interpretation. For those who are convinced that they have sighted a phantom at one time or another, there's a possibility that they did see something that could be interpreted as supernatural. But it wasn't a ghost. It just very well may have been an angel in transparent form, and it was no accident that they saw it. It is a reminder that angels are seen when they want to be, or at least when they are not concerned about being seen. It might have been the person's own spirit guardian, or someone else's. It is rare, but on occasion, according to Paul, one's angel, when appearing in transparent form, does allow itself to be seen by others for specific reasons and purposes. That's another thing, I said. If angels almost always appear as apparitions, why do I see you so much in physical form? I feel that it's important for me to appear in a personified form for the time being to give you a solid sense that you are talking to someone real, not a phantom, not a spirit, not a figment of your imagination. I want you to interact with me on the basis of man to man. I repeat, it's important. It was at this point that Paul made it abundantly clear, although he had earlier touched upon the subject tangentially, that many of our sessions were essentially going to consist of talk therapy. Despite my contention that it wasn't necessary, he decided to take on the responsibility of personally counseling me, just to be sure that I got the treatment that he believed I needed. I saw no point in arguing with an angel, so a regular regimen of sessions was scheduled. Actually, I liked them and I followed through on my vow to treat them as visits with a dear friend rather than as therapy with a doctor. In that respect, I also questioned him on his qualifications and wondered if he could be charged with practicing medicine without a license. What makes you think I'm unlicensed? He asked dryly. Touche. He nailed me on that one. As we strolled on, I remained rather intrigued by the visible, invisible business, the phantasmal versus the somatic presence, the tangible vis-a-vis the ethereal. It took much explaining, but I believe I finally got it sorted out. By the time he was through clarifying during which time we must have walked a couple of miles, passing half a dozen or more people, a number of other pressing questions that I was dying to ask also had been answered. Most people, of course, never see their guardian angels. However, a significant number become aware of them on a spiritual plane, somehow detecting the presence without actually seeing it. Those same people actually may see someone else's divine protector at some period in their lives. I am reminded of all the people who have seen Paul with me, never realizing that he was more than just another face in the crowd, far beyond what he appears to be. On those occasions when the spirit, protector of a particular person does reveal its presence visually, it is, as I have noted, usually as an apparition. I can imagine a gentle, religious person waking during the middle of the night to behold a spirit in the darkness. This has never happened to me, but in my imaginary scenario, the person is not afraid but actually quite welcoming to the visitor. And why not? This person is a believer whose faith is simply confirmed by the angelic presence. A soft, peaceful conversation between the two would not be surprising, maybe even expected. For example, when I was a kid, I heard my paternal grandmother talking to a relative about how she periodically awoke during the night to find an angel on her bed, stroking her silver locks. It gave me the willies at the time. I figured she was loco. For those people who do become aware of their guardians, and the vast majority never do, according to Paul, the relationship typically begins with a distinct feeling of a presence of some sort that can range in perception from a vague sense of connection to an undeniable conviction of a spiritual linking. Of course, I would have to classify myself as one of the lucky ones, being among those privileged individuals who not only have become aware of their divine guardian, but who actually see the angel in its many forms. I have now seen Paul both as an apparition visible to me only, and as a somatic presence, seemingly wearing everyday street clothes visible only to me at times but also to others at other times. And finally, there is the completely incarnate appearance when his physical presence is as real to any one person as it is to all other people, capable of being seen, heard, and bumped into. I personally know at least two people who talk with their personal angels on a regular basis but who have never seen the protector. Nevertheless, they are as certain of their presence and existence as they are of the bills that arrive on a regular basis in their mailboxes. And they are just as convinced that it is a two-way conversation, even if they never actually hear a response from the angel through their auditory system. The connection is spiritual, not physical. I thought I was beginning to understand. The big question. It was only a matter of time before I would ask Paul the question. On one of those picture-perfect days, while Paul and I took simple pleasure in observing a group of mothers watching over their brood of preschoolers squealing in delight as they scampered around a play area at a neighborhood park late in the morning, I finally decided I would pose it. I had already rehearsed the scenario in my mind. Is there a God? I would ask him quietly. Yet I had also wondered why I even had to ask. The answer seemed axiomatic, even to me. If guardian angels existed, then it stood to reason that God did also. How could it be otherwise? Paul's very being, which I fully accepted, was challenging one of my core beliefs or non-beliefs. I could see Paul, talk with him, touch him. That required no leap of faith on my part. And I had actually seen him materialize and dematerialize before my eyes, which in itself would be enough to convince most people that they had witnessed a miracle of divine origin. Yet, I was still not convinced. A natural explanation for Paul's superhuman powers could not yet be ruled out, and would be more to my satisfaction. The ultimate question of God's existence was a different matter. Once I reached adulthood, I had personally never believed in God, and my time spent with Paul would never be complete if I didn't pose the question, I had told myself on numerous occasions. I could no longer shunt the question aside, as I had been doing, pretending it wasn't there. The setting was just right. This was the kind of day that tapped into the human capacity to appreciate the sublime beauty of nature that lay before us in soul-satisfying grandeur, and the innocent joy of young children was on display before us. But now that the moment had arrived, I found myself unable to get the words out. My mouth worked fruitlessly, moving in an effort to form the words, but bringing forth only silence. I managed to choke out a couple of grunts, a stammered word or two, but that was all. My futile efforts pulled Paul's attention off the group of mothers and their children, and he eyed me curiously. What in the world was going on? I was perplexed. In actual fact, it was as though I literally had been struck dumb. I took a deep breath, consciously made an effort to calm myself, to collect my wits. While I was baffled and confused by my vain efforts, I was at the same time fascinated by the psychological and emotional forces obviously at work. I waved off Paul's curious looks, gave him a reassuring smile, and spent several minutes in intense reflection. And then I came to what I considered to be a reasonable conclusion. I couldn't force the words out because I knew that whatever answer Paul might give me, whether a definitive yes or no or a qualified alternative, I wouldn't accept it. That has nothing to do with my trust of Paul. In fact, it springs from everything that I had learned from him over the previous few months, to wit, no one can answer that question for another. The answer resides within each person, and only through a journey of introspection and discovery can the answer be revealed. For some, it is a short and easy jaunt. For others, the trail is tortuous, rugged and seemingly interminable. Some people make the pilgrimage for a lifetime and never see the end of the road. It is likely that I am one of those latter individuals. I think most people's religious beliefs are absorbed by osmosis from their parents or other caregivers, or from the culture in which they are raised. I don't have any studies in front of me to back that up, just empirical evidence based upon my own interaction with people. I personally don't know anyone among my friends, relatives, or acquaintances who arrived at their beliefs by embarking upon a scholarly quest, comparing the various beliefs and philosophies, and then determining which one made the most sense to them. When it comes to religion, my gut instinct tells me that too many people don't want to educate their children. They want to indoctrinate them. And I believe that's just what happens in most cases. I never adopted my parents' religious leanings, although I must admit that they never really tried to push their beliefs on me. My father tried half-heartedly to expose me to his church, but I had too many questions that he couldn't answer to my satisfaction, so he gave up after a while. He thought I was a smart aleck. My tendency to ask questions or to at least harbor doubts when it was impolitic to voice them goes pretty far back, at least to a 10th grade English class during which we were discussing religion, of all things. Well, others were, I didn't get involved. A fellow student expressed a belief that God existed but that he doesn't or isn't able to exercise any authority over the lives of humans. I believe that's the philosophy known as deism. Immediately the teacher interrupted him with a supercilious objection equivalent to a TSK. Oh, no, 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 my goodness, no, was her reaction, and she then blessed us with the truth. God is the creator and the ruler of the universe who is very much involved in human affairs, she informed us. I believe that's somewhat of a theist philosophy. Now, I was never what one would call the scholarly type, but even I saw the giant hole in that kind of argument. Yet I also wasn't the kind of kid who challenged authority, at least not openly. I remember the name of the teacher and the name of my classmate, who is now a retired professor from Stanford University and the author of a scholarly work on European cathedrals. Both the teacher and student were debating beliefs based upon faith, and faith is belief in something for which there is no evidence. Ergo, the student's belief was just as valid as the teacher's. However, I bit my tongue and kept that opinion to myself. I personally was not a believer in either position. It's possible that both were merely parroting what others had told them, who were told by others before them, who were told by others before them, ad infinitude all down the line to the very beginning. It slays me when people talk like they have acquired a monopoly on universal truths, as if they singularly hold the key to the mysteries of creation. For some reason, although I haven't traveled widely, such talk conjures up in my mind an ignorant, semi-literate old man spouting his wisdom to a following of equally uneducated rustics living in wretched poverty in some backwater. But this is Paul we are talking about, a guardian angel. Surely his word would be more authoritative, more credible than that of a mere mortal? But how do I know that for sure? I don't. Paul didn't have to spell it out for me, but one of the lessons that I learned over the course of our meetings led me to the conclusion that he was not going to be providing me with a spiritual or religious education. He was not going to bestow upon me a quick study in theology. If I happen to gain some knowledge and wisdom through an inner journey that leads to illumination, then I should consider myself fortunate. However, even if I never find the answer, the pilgrimage itself is worth the effort because of all the interesting and revealing places it takes one. There is no success or failure in the search. There is only the journey. I thought I understood. People who proclaim to believe or disbelieve in God because someone else said it is so have not found the answer. They haven't asked the question, how in hell do you know? They haven't asked for proof, for the evidence. They simply swallowed what they were fed. But that's no answer. In court, that's called hearsay, repeating what someone else allegedly said, and is inadmissible as evidence. And so the question, is there a God? Is meaningless unless it is asked of oneself. The courtroom and the jury are within. That is, paradoxically, the answer to the riddle. At least that's the way I see it. I opened with a different question. Are there times when you are not by my side? I asked. I mean, are you with me all the time? From birth to death, he replied simply. Amazing, was all I could muster at the moment. I had become aware of him less than 3 years earlier, and yet he had been my constant companion for 67 years, if his statement was accurate. I had no reason to believe that angels lie, so I accepted his word. All guardian angels? I asked. He gave me a questioning look. Are all guardian angels on duty 24/7 for a lifetime, or is that just your particular duty? It's more than just a 9-to-5 job, he said, giving me a knowing wink. However, that is not to say that I cannot be elsewhere at times when it is in your best interests. We moved on through the park. In a way, I was feeling cheated. I had wanted to ask a question that people had been asking since the first intelligent ancestors of humans started pondering the world round them. But whether or not there is a God, I had realized that Paul was not the one who would provide me the answer. Again, I was willing to admit that Paul's very existence, if I understood it correctly and wasn't being deceived, could make a strong argument for the affirmative. And there were other questions, millions of them. I could imagine the inquiries early humans must have formulated as they surveyed the wonders of a world whose workings were, to their primitive knowledge, nothing short of magical and miraculous. How do the sun, moon and stars stay up in the sky without falling? Why does the moon change shape? What causes the ground to shudder like a wild animal and burst forth in fiery anger? Where do the wind and rain come from? What causes the heavens to flash with streaks of fiery light and to roar and rumble with such fury as to strike sheer terror into the hearts of the bravest of men and women? What is the source of the water that falls from the sky? Science, of course, has provided the answers to all those early fundamental questions. But so many questions remain unanswered, and I was frustrated that the best hope I had to find the solutions in the form of Paul was not about to hand them to me, as I had once thought he could. The search must be continued. I have a serious privacy concern, I told Paul. How so? He asked. Well, if you are always at my side, and have always been at my side, does that mean that nothing I do ever escapes your notice? There are stalls around toilets in public restrooms for a reason. A man and a woman together, I mean, some things just require privacy. I'm your guardian angel. The stress is on guardian, he said. I watch over you. I try to keep you out of harm's way. I intercede in serious situations about 9 out of 10 times. But there are times when you don't need guarding. During those periods, I see nothing, I hear nothing. You are on your own then. Do you get my drift? I did. When I want to be alone, when I need to be alone, when my sense of dignity commands it, when my need for privacy requires it, Paul tunes me out. Or maybe he even goes elsewhere. Even the President of the United States is left alone by the Secret Service during private moments. Paul's reassurances in this respect put my mind at rest and helped me to relax, particularly during those periods when I am behind closed doors with the drapes drawn and the rest of the world is shut out. Over the months I would learn that Paul had saved my life on more than one occasion, and had pulled me from harm's way dozens of times over my lifetime. He had not only prevented me from being injured physically, but emotionally, financially, and psychologically as well. I was fascinated by his comment that he gets involved about 90% of the time in serious situations. What about that other 10% of the time when I need his help but he doesn't offer it? Well, into every life a little rain must fall. I never asked, and to this day can't imagine why the question never occurred to me then, but I simply assumed that everyone has about the same amount of protection as I have, a 90 hours 10 minutes ratio. That means that no one, prince or pauper, patrician or plebeian, gets through life unscathed. No matter how well protected, no matter how privileged, everyone suffers some degree of physical, psychological, emotional, spiritual injury throughout life. In a query about Paul's appearance in one of my previous books, a Russian immigrant taxi driver in New York wrote to ask me if everyone has a guardian angel. At the time I didn't have the answer, but I told him that even if that were so, it would still be a good idea for him to stop at red traffic signals. A belated answer to this cabbie's question would be, yes, everyone has a guardian angel. But it would be extremely foolhardy to use that information to justify a dangerously erroneous belief that one is invincible. As a result, people with guardian angels get sick, they get hurt, and they die at the rate of 2 million a year in the United States alone. Ultimately, we are each responsible for our own behavior. If a spirit guardian happens to extricate us from a threatening situation 9 times out of 10, let us consider ourselves fortunate. But who among us is perceptive enough to know where and when that intercession will occur? It could happen while we are skydiving, or when we are caught by the boss going through private papers on his desk when we thought he was out of the building. Yes, the latter caper, which might appear as harmless curiosity to some, also has the potential to cause devastating effects upon lives. For instance, at the Los Angeles Times on Sundays, during downtimes on the desk, copy editors used to gather in the managing editor's office during football season to watch games on his color television set. There were usually no high-ranking bosses in the newsroom at the time, so the atmosphere was pretty informal. I wasn't particularly interested in the games, but I would join the others just for the camaraderie. About 4 or 5 years after I joined the Times, I was sitting at the managing editor's desk one Sunday afternoon watching a game when my eye wandered to the work baskets on the executive's desk. There was a lone multi-page document in one of the baskets and, being the curious sort, I naturally took a gander at it. Lo and behold, if I hadn't stumbled upon one of the most tightly guarded secrets at the Times, it was a copy of the payroll records for the entire newsroom, listing current salaries, the previous year's merit raises, and recommended raises for that year. The document contained a checklist column for the managing editor to approve, disapprove, or revise those recommendations. What a revelation it was! I could see immediately who were the highest paid reporters, editors, and copy editors. And there were some startling surprises. For instance, there were only a handful of women copy editors on the main news desks, national, foreign and metro, maybe 4 or 5, and they were all at the bottom of the salary list. The office political implications would be staggering if this information ever got out. Some of the real workhorses on the reporting staff were drawing salaries well below those of others who were not particularly productive but were well connected politically and personally in the paper hierarchy. In some cases, there was a wide disparity in salary between reporters of equal rank, that is, in terms of abilities, productivity, and seniority, while there appeared to be a correlation between salary and political connections within the office. If I were a member of management, I would be aghast if that information got out. From the perspective of the working stiffs in the newsroom, the salary structure would be viewed as teeming with inequities, definitely unbalanced, and certainly crying out for some sort of modification, a fine-tuning, if you will. Well, somehow a copy of the document did get made, and a week or so later various members of the newsroom staff, about 20 of them, began receiving bulky envelopes through the mail. I rather imagine that the culprit, whose identity I can attest with absolute certainty, really had little or nothing to gain from the deed. So I would have to infer that he, or she, but let's assume it was a male, was simply playing a little prank while caught up in a moment of devilish madness. There's no doubt that it could have blown up in his face, however, if he got caught. The response was immediate. The Times photocopy machines went into overdrive as the 20 or so copies suddenly multiplied by the dozens. There probably wasn't a person in the newsroom who didn't have a copy or certainly access to one within a day or two. And the newsroom was one in an uproar. Everybody was comparing his or her salary to everybody else's, and all but the highest paid were screaming to their bosses. Discontent was rampant. The women were outraged over what they perceived, and rightfully so, as gender discrimination. Ranking officials from the managing editor down to the city editor were on the defensive, having been put in the extremely uncomfortable and untenable position of trying to explain to some of their best people why this slob or that slouch was making more money than they were. To prevent a rebellion in the ranks, the Times found it necessary to adjust the salaries of scores of people, and I wouldn't be surprised if the total was several hundred thousand dollars annually. That would be millions of dollars over the years. Whatever it was, it had to be substantial. A deputy managing editor who was not particularly popular in the newsroom was put in charge of the investigation to try to find the source of the leak. He spent months pursuing leads, so it was quite apparent that the company desperately wanted to catch the culprit. I went about my job, greatly amused by all of the commotion around me. I suspect that investigation went on for a long time behind the scenes. I overheard an animated conversation one day between the city editor and several subordinates. He proclaimed that as soon as the perpetrator was found, he was going to fire him and then punch him in the mouth. I was pretty sure that a nerve had been touched. Speculation in the newsroom continued for years. Several reporters came under suspicion, but the investigation led nowhere and finally ground to a halt. I had always thought that they hadn't even come close to finding the guilty party because the managing editor's office remained unlocked on weekends, and we copy editors continued to gather there for the televised football games. But in reality, according to Paul, the investigation eventually focused almost exclusively upon me. Now that came as a shocking surprise. I had never known until that moment that I had been a suspect. Just the thought of it gave me the heebie-jeebies. If they had pinned that rap on me, made me the fall guy, I could have lost everything. I literally had only recently, at that time, made it to what I considered the top of my profession, as high as I could reasonably expect to go based upon my limited education, experience, and abilities. My goal had been to serve securely in that position for the next 30 or 35 years, drawing what to me was a munificent salary and being provided with comfortable working conditions, an adequate retirement and health insurance system, and a job that I truly enjoyed. There was no other way for me to go except down if I failed to hang on to that position. In addition, I had been married for just a few years, had a new baby, and had recently purchased a house in the suburbs. Whatever would possess me to jeopardize all of it for some silly stunt? How could they even think such a thing? The additional money that the Times felt obliged to spend on higher salaries was going into the pockets of my brothers and sisters in the newsroom. I like to think that the rascal responsible had served as their unofficial labor representative, who had taken it upon himself to help win additional benefits for them through unconventional, unilateral bargaining. It wasn't as if he had sabotaged the presses and cost the company millions of dollars in unnecessary expenses. No one forced the Times to adjust the salaries. If it felt inclined to do so, one could interpret this as an admission that it had been shortchanging those employees. Personally, it didn't matter to me because my pay wasn't adjusted. Now, as to why I became a prime suspect, it seems that the head of the investigation had recruited one of his minions to snoop around and report back to him regularly with any intriguing scuttlebutt. When Paul informed me of this on that dark night in my backyard 30 years later, I recalled that one of my very good friends at the paper probably did see me at least leafing through the documents. I also was aware that he could have leapt to conclusions if he had seen me at the photocopy machine later performing some innocent little task. But this was a dear friend of mine, and even though I was fond of him, I have to admit that he was a bit of a gossip. In retrospect, I should have known that it was too much of a juicy tidbit to keep to himself during that period when the incident was the talk of the newsroom. My friend liked to end the day at the local watering hole, as did so many others in the newsroom, and it was there one evening when his well-oiled tongue slipped up. I don't know if the newsroom louse was present, but it would have been just a matter of time before the word would have been whispered to the oily Quisling. The little rat heard the rumor and went squealing to the editor investigating the matter, according to Paul.